Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free.
Hello, Chicago!
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we talk with legendary music producer and songwriter Jimmy Jam of the duo Jam and Lewis. I'm Greg Cott.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. And later in the show, we'll find out what song made Shirley Manson of Garbage want to become a rock star. But first, Jimmy Jam! That is a little bit of the song Somewhat Loved, featuring Mariah Carey from our guest this week, the incredible producer Jimmy Jam. Jimmy is best known as one half of the songwriting and production duo Jam and Lewis, alongside his partner Terry Lewis. They both grew up in Minnesota and began making music together in the late 70s, getting their start, working with a little-known artist from the area, but you might have heard of him. Prince, in a band that eventually became Morris Day and the Time, a little brother band to Prince and the Revolution. Since the early 80s, they've created huge hits for Janet Jackson, Mariah Carey, Boyz II Men, and so many more. However, Mr. Cott, for all of the accolades Jam and Lewis have accumulated, there was one thing left on their bucket list.
Yes, Jim, and over the years as I've interviewed Jimmy, I asked him about this. It was a million-dollar question in every Jimmy Jam interview.
Sure.
You know, you have worked with everybody on the face of the earth, it seems like, had hits with so many artists, and yet Jam and Lewis somehow never found the time to get together and do their own record. Well, now, almost 40 years after they began, Jam and Lewis have released their debut record, Jam and Lewis Volume 1.
A promising title, saying Volume 2 might be coming. We caught up with the legendary producer and songwriter Jimmy Jam and started the conversation by asking him, what the heck took so long?
Well, a lot of things got in our way, mostly artists that we were working with over the years. I mean, we started really the process of doing our album back before we did Control with Janet. And Janet kind of famously at this point ended up stealing a song from our album, which turned into What Have You Done For Me Lately?
Yeah.
So that started on the her on her career and started ours, you know, as writers and producers and not artists. And it just kind of continued along that way over the years. You know, we'd say to an artist, hey, we're doing a song for our album. They'd go, great. And then we'd do it. And then they'd go, I got to keep this for myself. So finally, we got selfish. 3 or 4 years ago, we went in the Songwriters Hall of Fame. And when they asked us what we hadn't done yet, we said, well, we never got around to doing our album. So we want to do that. And then everything we did from that point on that we said was going to be for our album, we kept for our album. And finally, we got an album.
Yeah. Well, I have to think, you know, you've had 31 top 10 hits in the UK, 41 in the US, 16 Billboard number ones. Somewhere along the way, you go, these are damn good songs. Let's save one of them. You know, like maybe even if you'd done like a one-a-year pace where you basically were on the charts for like a 15-year straight period, you know, like on the top of the charts. Did that ever enter your mind, like, we're just going to save this one for us? I mean, was it ever entering your mind during that real big hot streak that you guys had, especially?
No. I mean, once we got started, we were basically on our way. You know, And it was all in the moment. I don't think we were really planning. We always had a long-term plan about kind of what we saw for our careers. And so a lot of our decision-making process was based on the long-term things rather than the quick, you know, fix, I guess you would say. So, but in the midst of kind of the chart run that's, you know, continued for a while for us now, I think we just always felt like it was happening in the time that it should happen. We didn't really question the timing of it. And, you know, as the thing that naturally would happen is we would have, if you had a hit record with an artist, then there would always be the next record. It would be like, what are you going to do for the next record? Or what are you going to do for the next record? So, you know, from whether it was, you know, back in the day, whether it was SOS Band or Sherelle or Alexander O'Neill, or later on with Janet or New Edition, or, you know, or Mary J. Blige or whatever, it was always, if you had that record, it was always following that record up. That was always the priority. So really doing our own album really went way, way, way to the back burner, where it wasn't like a priority for us at all at one point.
And I've read interviews, Jimmy, with you and Terry. There's this Midwestern work ethic. I love the stories that are coming out now because people are looking at the whole career as you talk about Volume 1. And just arriving in L.A. after Prince fires you from the Time. You know,
my partner Terry says freed. He freed us.
He freed him. Well, you know, those 8 and 10 hour rehearsals and you were daring to do other recording in between. So you guys are young producers in L.A. and you would just take any job. You know, sometimes artists, there was an Ice-T track I saw referenced, you know, $500. You show up, you craft the track. You know, you had this, and then, you know, that grows into Janet, right? So I can understand how you never saved anything. You're there to do the job. You're going to do the best job. The record shows it was the best job, right? But you know, how did that Midwestern work thing play into your attitude?
Well, I think the environment we grew up in the Midwest, definitely, it was two things. I think one, it was kind of that nobody really cared what it was that you did. There wasn't kind of this status, like in LA, there's this whole kind of status thing, what kind of car you drive or what kind of house you have, or you know, there's a whole kind of materialistic thing. There wasn't any of that up there, at least not that we felt. It was more about the substance of who you were. And good hard days of work, no matter what it was that you did, be excellent at what it was that you did. And there was a value to that. So I think we had, you know, that was instilled in us. And also, I can't underrate the musical environment that we grew up in, because, you know, where things were still kind of regionalized, it was before the internet and all that. So New York records had a certain sound, LA records had a certain sound, Detroit records had a certain sound, Philly records had a certain sound. We were kind of getting the melting pot of all of those different sounds in the Midwest. And also, growing up, for me personally, I was listening to pop radio growing up because there was a Sun Up to Sundown black station, but you couldn't get it if you tilted your antenna the wrong way. You wouldn't get it. So I grew up really with pop music. So, and Minneapolis, though, very much art-centric, very much, yep. You know, museums, yep. Symphonies. Yeah. I grew up as a kid. My mom and dad were always taking me to plays or museums or to see the Minnesota Orchestra play or all of that. So I was just immersed in a really great artistic atmosphere, but certainly one, when you talk about work ethic, really was about, you know, the job wasn't what you did for your job, but how you did your job. That was always the important thing. And you know, the not the final thing I'll say on it, but that was all culminated working with Prince, because Prince was that person that outworked everybody, but he had the talent. He had more talent than anybody. So he could have just got by on his talent, but he worked like someone that didn't have any talent. And when you combine that, that's when you end up with the, you know, whether it's the Michael Jordans or the Tiger Woods or the, you know, the people I always think of athletes, like when they're at their absolute excellence, it's because of that combination of things where they're uber talented on their own, but then they outwork everybody too. And that's the kind of people you want leading to you. So work ethic to me was the thing that Prince gave us. Also, besides the environment, is working with Prince gave us that work ethic that we could really outwork people. And that's what we tried to do. All apart.
Yeah, it's all about team, too. I mean, that's another, talk about another Midwestern thing. Creating a body of work with people. When you worked on albums, I remember you telling me how much you loved being able to do a whole album with an artist as opposed to just an individual track. And that was really different for that era. That, you know, as you know, you'd have 10, 12 producers on a record if you were a pop artist, you know, and here Jam and Lewis were doing Jam and Lewis records. Like, it was a thing. And that's a really canny way of, you know, now they'd call it branding, you know, but back then it was, you know, probably didn't have that word. But how did you figure that out, like, early on? Like, that was, this is how we work, and we work best when we're doing this. So how were you able to, say, like, an artist like Janet Jackson, say, you know, we'd like to do this whole album. I mean, what was the give and take, like, with the record label and the management, people like that, when you were able to do those kind of things back in an era when that was not the thing to get mainstream recognition?
I think for me, I know that we were always into the idea of albums. I remember listening to, like, Motown records back in the day, and my whole thing was always who wrote and produced it. As a matter of fact, the reason I even knew the term writing and producing was because of the Holland Dozier Holland album. I think it was called The Supreme Sing Holland Dozier Holland. And I just remember this gold album cover, and I remember looking at, I asked my dad, I said, what does this mean? Because to me, Holland was a country. I didn't know Holland was a person, you know. And I just said, what does this mean? And he said, oh, they're the songwriters. And I said, the songwriters. Oh, wow. That's when it went off into my head, songwriters. And I said, how do you know the songwriters? And he said, well, when you get, and he gave me a 7-inch, you know, a little 45. And he said, see in the little parentheses, those are the people that write the songs. And from that moment, that was always my fixation. Whenever I got a 7-inch or an album, and it was more 7-inch back in that day because I didn't get albums, but when I'd get singles, I'd always look to see the names in the parentheses. Mm. So for me, that was always the value, the thing that attracted me was the writing and the production and those types of things. Janet's a great example, Greg, because Janet was, I remember when John McClain, the A&R person at A&M Records, at that time, he said, who on the A&M roster do you want to do? And we went down the list, which was, I think, might have been faxed to us. I think fax machines existed at that point.
Yeah, they did.
And we looked down the list, and Terry and I's finger both stopped at Janet's name. And we said, John, we want to do Janet. And he said, great. You want two or three songs? And we were like, no, we want to do the whole album. And he was like, the whole album? And we said, yeah. Really? And we like, yeah. And it was like, okay, cool. Now, we had done, before that, though, if you think about it, when we were working with Clarence Avant for his Taboo Records, and we did the whole Alexander O'Neill album and the whole Sherelle album. Mm-hmm. We did half the SOS Band album. I remember the first SOS Band album, but we didn't, you know, we did the half of it because we were like the new guys on the block. But our songs were the singles and the hits on the record, and the other songs were just on the album, but the people were getting paid more than we were getting paid because they had more songs, and we were like going, no, we need to do the whole album. So I think that was part of it, besides the artistic nature of doing it. There was also the economics of it. It was like, if we're going to be contributing the songs that are the hit songs, then why not be on the whole album if we can do that? But it changed. What was great about it was then it gave us a chance to do sequencing of the album, to do interludes, to do all of the things, and to create, like, just kind of a story, you know, which was, to me, important. And when I think about our favorite music that we've ever done, it's always been albums that we've controlled the whole album, whether it was New Edition, whether it was Sounds of Blackness, whether it was Alexander O'Neill Hearsay, which is one of our all-time favorites. But that was where we did all the songs. And then obviously we had that with the Janet albums, most of the Janet albums we did.
And it worked out well. I mean, those albums stand as defining that era and stand beginning to end. Before we get a second further from it, I've always wanted to ask you about your dad, Jimmy. Cornbread Harris, right? Minneapolis blues and jazz musician. When I lived in Minneapolis, you know, one of the things that's hardy about Minneapolis, it's February, it's minus 20, and you still go out to the pub to see Ray and Glover play. You know, the great blues musicians, right? So besides telling you what songwriters did, inspiring you there, what else did you get from Cornbread?
Every bit of my musical talent, I guess you could say. I grew up in an environment in my house where, as a kid, I was that kid that's always banging on stuff, always beating on stuff. I think I was that kind of kid. So my parents got me a drum set. When I was, I want to say, I always think I was 3 years old. Maybe I was 5 years old, but for some reason, I think I was 3 years old. And I got this little drum set. And my dad would play the organ and I would play drums along with him. And I remember then, because there was always keyboards around the house, I'd always mess around with the keyboards a little bit. But I always thought of myself as a drummer. And so later on in life, when I was 12,
yeah.
I used to go to my dad's gigs. He would gig on the weekend at different clubs and stuff. And he had a trio called Huckleberry Finn, Cornbread, and Friends. And the Friends was, well, actually it was Friend, I guess, not plural, but just Friend. So it was basically a drummer, guitar player, and then my dad. All away, but I say put the world back together. Put the world back together. Put the world. Well, every week, it seemed like there was a different drummer. He never could keep a drummer. Mm. And so one week, the guitar player, who was a guy named Coffee was great. And Coffee said, why don't you let your son drum? He knows the set. Mm. And he said, oh, he's kind of young. And he said, oh, go ahead. I mean, the drummer's not here yet. So I ended up drumming the first set. He would do four sets a night. I drummed the first set, and it went over really well. So the next week, I think I went back, same problem with the drummer. I ended up drumming the whole night that night and doing all four sets. So the next week, I think, I don't know whether I asked or whether my mom said, you should just let him drum. He knows all the songs. And okay, cool. And so my mom said, well, what are you going to pay him? And he said, oh, I don't know, I'll give him $20 or whatever, whatever. And she said, no. You got to pay him just like you pay like a real drummer. You got to pay him like that. So that kind of started my first little savings account.
There you go.
And my mom was my agent. Yeah. And, you know, it was really set me on my path of my love of music. The other thing that it did in a weird way was my dad had kind of given up music at a point where to basically to raise me. And it made me feel like, I remember him and my mom used to argue about it all the time because there'd be like a certain gig he'd want to do, or he wanted to take a leave of absence from work and go, you know, do some gigs and do some things. And I remember being in the recording studio with him, you know, listening to some of the records he was doing, and I thought they were great. But he ultimately just said, well, I said I'd give up music and, you know, raise my kid and, you know, be married. And that's what he ended up doing. So it set me on a path of never wanted to get married, and I never wanted to have kids. Like, that was my thing. I was like, I'm not going to let anybody, you know.
They interfere with music, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to let anybody ruin my career, right? But interestingly enough, when I left school a little bit early, I won't say I dropped out, but I will say that I left school a little bit early. And I remember I thought when I told my mom that school wasn't for me, I said, I don't really want to do it. I thought she was going to hit the ceiling, right? And she just kind of said, you know, if that's what you want to do and that's what you're feeling, you should do that. As long as I see you really working hard every day to work on your music. And I was shocked when she said that. And I was like, okay, cool. Well, and then at that point in my life, I think I was probably 17 years old, I think. And I remember I was working at a record store. I was DJing at the roller rink. I was DJing at the couple of nightclubs. I had a radio show. I was doing everything musically I could possibly do. I was writing songs. I was doing everything. And later on, somebody said to me Do you think the reason that your mom let you do that was because she didn't let your dad pursue it? And I never thought about it like that. And then I thought, yeah. And the thing that was cool about it, though, as it turned out, in storybook fashion, I guess you could say, was, you know, the one thing I regretted was that my mom never got to see me graduate. She never got to see me walk across the stage and graduate. But my mom was my date at the Grammys when we were nominated for Producer of the Year. And when we won Producer of the Year and I walked across the stage with a Grammy, that was almost like my graduation. And it was like, it was that sense of really her belief in me, really culminating at that moment. So that was a that was super special for me.
When we return, more of our conversation with Jimmy Jam, including the secret to a long-lasting work partnership on Sound Opinions.
And we are back. Let's jump back into the conversation with producer and songwriter Jimmy Jam.
You know, I wanted to get back to your partner, Terry, the relationship you guys have, Terry Lewis. You two have been together for so many years, and this goes back to my teamwork question. You've been working together for a long time. Partnerships like this are difficult to maintain. It's like, talk about being married. This is like being married to somebody, right? I mean, it's a, your partner. You're doing work together. They say never be married and work together. Well, you guys basically have done that for 40-plus years. How are you able to avoid conflict, or maybe you don't, but I'm curious because I know that you're kind of the music, you're more the music guy, and Terry was allegedly more the lyric guy, and I'm sure there was bleeding back and forth, you know, but could Terry ever tell you, you know, Jimmy, this riff, this melody here, or this arrangement's not doing it for me, and vice versa, could you tell him, you know, Terry, go back to the drawing board with that lyric, that's not going to work. I mean, what was that relationship like when you're in writing these songs together?
Well, I think we definitely have always been very honest with each other. As a matter of fact, when we first started trying to write songs together, because of kind of the difference of our musical influences, as I said earlier, I was more of the pop guy. So my thing was, you know, Seals and Crofts and America, and major seventh chords and harmonies. Like, that was the thing I loved. Terry was Parliament Funkadelic, just the funk, you know, whatever the funk was, that was what he was into. And so when we tried to write together initially, I would come up with these, you know, beautiful chords and melodies and stuff, and then Terry would put this funky bottom on it, and I'd go, oh, no, that's, no. And then, or vice versa, Terry would come up with this funky beat or funky bass line or whatever, and then I put these pretty chords over the top of it, and it was like, oh, no, no, that's not right. So that was kind of the way we kind of, that was sort of our seasoning of getting to know each other. And we finally hit it. We finally hit the right combination around the time of probably Just Be Good to Me, I would say, was kind of the first example of kind of the funky bottom and the pretty top, I guess, as people kind of call it. So I think that was the thing. But as far as our relationship and getting along, there's a few foundational things that we did. One was, as a partnership, we shook hands. And when we shook hands, we basically said 50-50. So what by saying that, what we meant was is that whatever we do is 50-50. So if it's a song I write all by myself, it's 50% his. If it's a song he writes all by himself, it's 50% mine. And that alleviates probably 99% of anything that you would ever argue over, because if you are going to have, you know, an argument over, well, that's my lyric, well, that's my melody, well, that's my music, well, that's my title, well, that's my bridge, or that, I mean, all the, you know, as you break apart all the different kinds of music, there's literally songs that come out, even to this day. Matter of fact, today, we just released a couple of songs over in Japan. And one of the songs, I hadn't heard it. They just sent it to me and they said, hey, this is coming out today. And I never had heard it. And I texted Terry and I said, hey, when'd you do this? And he said, oh, I did this the other day, whatever. And I said, oh, yeah, that sounds really great. But you know what? It's 50% mine. So it's always Jam and Lewis at the end of the day. And there's certain artists that will swear to God that if it's someone like Usher is a great example, is someone who him and Usher just get along and they just do their thing. And I come in when I need to, but I'm not there all the time. And a lot of times I know Usher feels like, where's Jam? Does Jam do anything? You know? And
then I thought I was paying for two of them.
Maybe the vice versa. You know, it's like, Jam does everything. What does Terry do? I never see him, you know?
Yeah.
But so that's once again, that's another thing that works in our favor. The last thing I'll say is that we don't, I use the word argue. We took the word argue out of stuff because to me, arguing is something that you're trying to win. You're trying to win an argument. Mm-hmm. So if you win an argument, that means the other person lost. So I don't want to ever be responsible for Terry losing at anything. He never wants to be responsible for me losing. So we, instead of using the word arguing, we use the word disagreement. Yes, we disagree. So a disagreement is something you're trying to solve. So the idea is, let's solve the disagreement. If you feel this way about it, I feel this way about it, what's the best way? Not whether it's my way or whether it's your way, what's the best way to solve this? And that philosophy has worked well for, you know, 40 plus years of our existence. And that's what we do. So I think, and we've never, so I always say we've never had an argument because we just never have. But the other thing I'll say is in the freedom to do, it's almost like freedom to do what we do together, but we do it apart a lot of times. I know people think we're just joined at the hip. But a lot of times there's a project that Terry's totally into and that's he's doing that project. There's a project I'm totally into. But at the end of the day, it's all Jam and Lewis.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really matter. So we just do what we think is the best.
Yeah. I don't know what he was talking about there, Jimmy, because we've been doing this show for 25 years. And I don't think we've ever argued. Well, we argue about whether we like a record or not. But I think the word producer is still one that confuses many of our listeners or even the most knowledgeable music fans. And as journalists, we've interviewed so many producers. And I always like to ask, whether it's you or Brian Eno, about exactly what that means. And then I saw a great interview that Tony Braxton did. One of the standout tracks on Volume 1 is Happily Unhappy. Fantastic song, right? You know, and she could, of course, sing anything. But man, to sing a song that great. And somebody asked her, you know, what did those guys do? And she said, they're therapists. So that element of how do you, obviously, you know, Janet had a lot at stake making Control. Or, you know, when you're working with Michael Jackson on History, you know, difficult point in his career. How much of it is technical, you got your Roland TR-808 under your arm, and how much of it is I'm here to try to make this person comfortable so they're at their creative best?
Well, at the end of the day, to me, producing is getting the best performance out of the artist. So to me, it's akin to directing in a movie. You're trying to get the best performance out of an actor. So in that way, some of it is the technical side. I mean, you do need to know. I mean, you're going to make decisions based on, you know, what drum machine you should use, which keyboards you should use, collaborating with what the artist would like and the record company would like, because you're trying to kind of balance all of those things, you know, whether it should be up-tempo, whether it should be a ballad, whether it should be, you know, whether we should do live strings or live instruments or whether it should be, you know, sequenced or, I mean, all of those kinds of decisions all go into it. But the psychology of it, the psychiatry of it, is to me the absolute most important thing, because you're trying to make the studio environment, and sometimes it's not a studio. Sometimes it's a hotel room. Sometimes it's you know, nowadays with technology, it can be a laptop in a hotel room or in a beach house or you can really do it anywhere.
Yeah.
But you try to find that safe space. You want the artist to feel like whatever's happening in that room, it's intimate. It's safe space. It's a space to explore. It's a space to make mistakes, but not have to worry about anybody ever hearing it, and all of those things. I'll give you my favorite example of the psychology or the psychiatry, I guess you will, of making a record as producers is the New Edition Heartbreak album. Mm. So New Edition was going through a whole lot of things. They had Bobby Brown had left the group. They were trying to decide whether to continue on with just the four guys or whether to add Johnny Gill to the group. You had two of the guys didn't want Johnny in the group. Two of the guys thought Johnny being in the group was going to be a great thing. So we knew when we set out to do the record that the first thing we needed, the elephant in the room was Johnny Gill. So I remember in Minneapolis around our little conference table, we sat all the guys down. And we just said to Johnny Gill, we just looked at him and we said, okay, Johnny, here's our thought. You're not going to sing any songs on this album because it's Ralph's group. And Ralph's going to do all the vocals, and just like normal, how do you feel about that? And we didn't know what Johnny was going to say. This wasn't set up. We didn't know. And Johnny just kind of looked at us and said, well, hey, man, I'm a team player, so whatever you need me to do, I'm just here to support. Mm-hmm. And we said, great. At that moment, the elephant was gone. Yeah. And actually, Ralph and Johnny became the Mutual Admiration Society, where literally whenever we were working on a Ralph vocal, Johnny was the guy in the control room going, wow, I can't believe he's doing all those backgrounds. That's amazing. Mm. And then when Johnny was singing, Ralph was in the control room going, wow, Johnny's killing it all. He's so amazing. So, but if that meeting wouldn't have taken place, it wouldn't have mattered all the technical songs or all of the writing. It wouldn't have mattered because there would have been this cloud hanging over the project.
On a perfect day, I know that I can count on you. When that's not possible, tell me, can you ever restore?
'Cause I need somebody who will stand by.
So when I say Tony's statement is absolutely right, therapists, because that's what we need to be for the artists. The artists, think about the artists, how tough it is with the expectations that you have from your fans, from the record label. You're thinking about budget, you're thinking about videos, you're thinking about all kinds of different things, and you still are expected to just go in and crank out music. So to me, you have to have that person whose ear you can kind of bend and go, hey, is this right? Or how do you feel about this? Or get through the insecurities or whatever those things are. And to me, that's really our job. If we don't take care of that side of the job and recognize when somebody maybe is not having a good day, or maybe, you know, so maybe we just talk, we don't really work on anything necessarily. Or maybe when somebody is in peak voice, maybe they don't even feel it, but maybe that rasp in their voice because they have a cold, like Nasty on Janet's record.
Yeah.
She had a cold that day, and she was trying to sing it high. I said, 10 in the movie. I was like, no. Sing it like, she was like, 10 in the movie. I said, yeah, sing it like that.
10 in the movie show, thinking nasty thoughts.
You know, but just recognizing all of those things. People have to feel comfortable enough to even do that and trust you with it, so, yeah.
Speaking of trust, you know, I always felt like your best work, you're tailoring songs to a particular artist. It always felt like this fits them perfectly. And there's this thing about songwriters, you got so many songs, and like there's this giant pool of songs out there, and we're going to pick out these three or four for this artist, you know, whatever. I mean, so how does that work? Like, you know, when you listen to the Volume 1, you know, Spinning, you go, of course Mary J. Blige has to sing that song. You know, that's a Mary J. Blige song. Yeah. So, I mean, how does it work? Did you pick the song to fit the artist, or do you pick the artist and then figure out what the song's going to be?
Yeah, the songs always come from the artist. They're always inspired by the artist. We've kind of always worked like that because in the old days, you know, people would hire us to produce something. And then they, you know, when we would get with the artist, we would actually sit with them, try to get to know them, try to figure out what it was that they wanted to sing about or talk about. But also we would go back in the case of, you know, like SOS Band, like I say, which was one of our first ones that we did that was super successful. We always did our homework. Their biggest hit at that point in time was Take Your Time, Do It Right. So we kind of dissected that song in our minds, that it was a repetitive bass line, that it had a lot of sophisticated instruments like glockenspiel and things that you wouldn't necessarily hear, you know, on an R&B record at that point in time. And we kind of took all of those things and then said, okay, if we were making that record or the follow-up to Take Your Time, Do It Right, what would it sound like? And then we came up with Just Be Good to Me. So that's kind of the process. So for volume one, yeah, it was like, well, if we could do a Mary J. Blige song right now, what would we want that song to sound like? And then that's the song we would write. And we kind of did that with all of the artists. So the artists mm-hmm. were always the inspiration for what we came up with. Because we always wanted songs, our productions to really be tailor-made for the artist. And my analogy always is like a tailor. If you go in to get a suit made and you go into the tailor shop and you pick out your material and the color and you pick out the style, you know, four button, double breasted, whatever those things are. At the end of the day, you have a suit that fits you perfectly. Now, the thread that sews the suit and the way those threads are put together, now that's going to be the tailor is going to have a style in doing that. And that's what Terry and I think of ourselves as tailors in that way, that yes, there are certain threads that run through a Jam and Lewis song or production, because that's just the way we do it. But we try to make sure that it's individualized for each person. So they wear that suit better than anybody else could possibly wear it. And that's kind of the idea of it.
When we come back, Jimmy Jam shares his thoughts on the evolution of R&B and where he thinks the genre is heading next. Plus, Shirley Manson of Garbage on the song that got her hooked on Sonics on Sound Opinions.
We're back. This week, we're talking with songwriter and producer Jimmy Jam of the legendary duo Jam and Lewis. Let's jump back in.
I've seen you guys in the interviews you're doing for Volume 1. You've coined this word. You're proud of it. Nostalgia. So the first time you listen to it, you're like, wow, this could have been done in mid-80s, right? And, of course, this is the patented Jam Lewis sound. So I don't want to ask you about nostalgia because it's not a throwback. I mean, these songs are vital, vibrant, and alive today. What I want to ask you, Jimmy, about is the directions R&B took post your biggest heyday. You know, we have like R. Kelly and things get really dirty and lewd and lascivious. And now we have a new generation of R&B people. I'm thinking of Frank Ocean. Right, and people like that coming up who are doing the kind of genre blending that you guys had done earlier in a less, you know, made for mainstream radio kind of way. But mainly because they don't have the money, right? You know, everybody's in their bedroom now, right? But I'm wondering about the evolution as you see it of R&B over the last 30, 40 years since your career spans it.
Well, to me, the evolution of R&B is really, and at least new, well, I think things go full circle. I do think that. I think there was a time during the 80s when we started that R&B got very influenced by certainly Minneapolis and the things that yep. Prince was doing, where he was taking things like Sly and the Family Stone and mixing them with things like Fleetwood Mac and, you know, all these kind of different Carlos Santana and all these different types of things, and then doing it through kind of a James Brown / Sly and the Family Stone, you know, makeup, right? So there was all of those types of things. But he also did a remake of, like, you know, Bet You by Golly Walt by the Stylistics. Like, you know, he was always aware of kind of the through line of R&B music, which was kind of interesting. I think that, you know, obviously the drum machine era when it was happening that we were in the middle of, but we always tried to keep something organic about it. Like even if we used a drum machine to make the beat, we still would do live cymbals, or we do live percussion, ping zing zings as we call it. To this day, we still do that. Yeah. And also the fact of not so much doing loops as much as playing from start to finish. So that one unique line happened, you know, at 2 minutes and 30 seconds of a song that you don't hear again, that you have to hear the whole song in order to get to that point. So I think all of those things kind of impacted our evolution. And then when New Jack Swing happened, which then put hip hop into it, and then sampling happened, I think we always embraced all of those types of influences. And so now it's almost like in full circle in a way, where you have artists like Giveon, for instance, or Her, who kind of have built their careers, Her in particular, who really, the whole idea of going out and playing live in front of an audience to kind of get your seasoning and to learn how to play the instruments that are making the music rather than doing it in a laptop, she kind of embodies to me all of those great kind of things about music. So,
and she's truly a mind-blowing artist.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's absolutely amazing. And so but to know that she's very influenced by, you know, Janet was a huge influence on her. Matter of fact, the record we have out right now, Damage, it's number one, been number one off and on for the last month or so, was very much influenced by Janet, Making Love in the Rain, Herb Alpert. So I just think, and when I say nostalgia, to me, it is the idea of hearing something new, like the discovery moment when you discover an artist or you discover a song. There's something that's so invigorating about that. And you not only do you hear it, but you want to hear tell other people about it, right? When you hear whatever that is, there's something exciting about that. But there's also something very, very comforting about something familiar, you know, something that makes you, not necessarily that it sounds, but it takes you back. It's like time travel. Mm. And so that's kind of what we wanted to do with the album, is we wanted to kind of have this sense of time travel where it sounds like, you know, you mentioned Mary J. or Toni Braxton or Boyz II Men, or, you know, it sounds like the way it sounded when you fell in love with those artists for the first time. Mm-hmm. Although it doesn't necessarily directly sound like the way they sounded then, but it gives you the feeling of that. But it also gives you the excitement of there's new music by them that's actually good, you know, which sometimes there's not. I say this all the time. It's always great when an artist comes back. You always read, oh, so-and-so's coming back with an album. And your first thought is, oh, that's great. I can't wait to hear it. And then a lot of times you hear it and you go, I'm glad they came out with a new album, but I'm going to go listen to their old stuff.
Right, right. You know, it's almost a sense of dread. They might let me down. You know, but I think of like Prince working with some of his heroes, like Chaka Khan, and it's like, and Mavis. All right, you know.
Mavis Staples, too.
Mavis Staples,
By the way, just that reminds me of something that Terry always used to say to Prince all the time, because Prince would always talk about, you know, us as producers, and he would always say, you know, you guys are just trying to go for hits and, you know, whatever. And we're like, no, we're not. Prince, we're really not. What we're trying to do is to make everybody sound like themselves, the most like themselves as they can possibly sound. And he was like, oh, I don't know about that. And then Terry would go, Prince, make something that doesn't sound like you when you produce it. And then talk about us.
Right. I love the Prince impression.
So Chaka's a perfect example, because I just literally was listening the other day. I saw Chaka about a month ago at the National Museum in African American Music in Nashville. Mm. She was at the opening of that. And I saw her down there, and we were talking about the Funk This, the album that we did. And it was so much, we said we wanted to make a Rufus album with her. And she said, what do you mean by a Rufus album? And I said, we just want to be the band, and you just sing, and then we'll put it all together and do that. And I think it's the most authentically Chaka-sounding record that, you know, she probably made in years. And that was kind of our idea. But when, you know, her and Prince hooked up, or when Mavis hooked up, and some of these people, George Clinton hooked up, a lot of those records ended up sounding, to me, like, too Prince-like, just for me, rather than let the artist be the artist. So that's one of the things we've always tried to do.
Out of control.
Jimmy Jam, a hot upcoming artist, debut album with Terry Lewis, Volume 1.
The first one's always the toughest one, Jimmy. It gets easier
for me. 40 years in the making. Yeah. thank you, Jimmy. It's been a pleasure having you on Sound Opinions.
Thanks, you guys, for having me. Appreciate it.
That concludes our conversation with the great Jimmy Jam, and now we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite Jam and Lewis track? Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, with your pick and why. Also, watch our podcast feed for an upcoming bonus episode with more of that interview.
We still have more, Greg, and we felt like we could have talked with Jimmy all day. And if we had Terry, it would have been like a week-long conversation. Last week, our beloved producer, Alex Claiborne, got the chance to interview one of her musical heroes, Shirley Manson of Garbage, a Sound Opinions bonus podcast exclusive.
Alex also asked her about a track that inspired her to make music. Let's hear about the song that made Shirley feel like a rock star and got her hooked on Sonics.
I wanted to pick something that I haven't talked about a lot, you know, because obviously there's a million and one artists who inspired me to do what I do. But I've never really given voice to the Stray Cats. And so I picked Stray Cats Strut.
I strut right by with my tail in the air. Stray Cats Strut, I'm a feeling Casanova. Garbage can.
They really came out at a time, I think it was the early 80s when I first heard this song. Me and my friends were all really into rockabilly. We were listening to, you know, Buddy Holly and Eddie Cochran and Gene Vincent and, you know, all that old, like Elvis Presley. And we were all sort of obsessed and we all dressed, you know, with our hairs and quiffs and leather jackets and motorbike boots, and we had our own sort of weird punk version of Americana going on in Scotland. And then I heard this record by the Stray Cats, and I can remember being in my parents' front room with a red leather Dansette record player, and I played this song over and over and over. And I was singing into, you know, a hairbrush or something. I don't exactly know what it was. It could have been anything. It could have been a spoon. But I would sing along with this song and imagine myself on stage. I can still really remember that feeling of imagining that I was one of the Stray Cats. And when Brian Seltzer goes into that guitar solo, that incredible, swaggery, beastly guitar solo. I don't know, it's just like that weird lick that he does. It's just so hot. And it ignited in me a desire to be a musician, to be on stage, to create that feeling in other people that they all were making it in me. And I had the good fortune to run into Slim Jim very recently. He lives in LA and he's married to a bass player from Eagles of Death Metal, and she's Genevieve is beautiful, and I've known her since she was a fan of Garbage, since she was a kid herself, and she's gone on to have an amazing career. And anyway, through Genevieve and I got to hang out with the amazing Jim, Slim Jim Phantom, and it's just a lovely cyclical moment in my career where, you know, not only am I meeting someone that really inspired me and his band inspired me, but his lovely wife was once one of our fans and then grew up and became a rock and roll star herself. And it just feels magical every time I'm with them.
That was Stray Cat Strut by the Stray Cats, the song that got Shirley Manson hooked on Sonics.
Wow, I would not have expected that.
Didn't think that Shirley would dredge up what would you call them?
You know, as rockabilly revivalists, they were at the top of the list.
Revivalists is the word.
Revivalists,
right?
Yes. Mr. Cott, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, you cannot have Halloween without ghosts. We got a bunch of songs about our favorite ghost stories. And this week, our bonus podcast. I take us on a trip across the pond to the desert island and play a song I cannot live without.
For more sound opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors.
And speaking of sponsors, every week our show reaches hundreds of thousands of curious listeners from around the globe via podcast and on 150 public radio stations nationwide. If you'd like to learn more on how your business or organization can also reach this engaged and educated audience, you can email sponsor at soundopinions.org. That's sponsor at soundopinions.org.
Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo, and our new intern, Mary Bernthal. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott.